Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 19th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we'll be reading the following main articles. Response to Threats is Up to Schools by Carolyn Thompson. Redistricting, GOP Chips Away at Black Dems' Power by Nick Corasaniti and Reed J. Epstein. How Many More Will We Lose? By Meg Wingerter. And Hits Keep Coming, Hospitals Struggle as COVID-19 Beds Fill by Ed White, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Security, Response to Threats is Up to Schools. U.S. educators have to decide what to do when facing potential violence in classrooms, by Carolyn Thompson, The Associated Press. School systems nationwide rely on high-level expertise from the U.S. Secret Service and others as they work to stay vigilant for signs of potential student violence, training staff, surveilling social media, and urging others to tip them off. When it comes to how to respond to a possible threat, however, it's the local educators who make the call. In the November 30th shooting at the Oxford Township, Michigan High School, authorities say the 15-year-old student charged with killing four peers was allowed to remain in school despite troubling behavior, including a drawing of a handgun and a person with bullet wounds. The school's handling of the student before the shooting is among the topics under investigation. Security experts and school administrators say there is detailed guidance to help schools recognize concerning behavior and when to intervene. But exactly how to respond, including whether to remove students from school property or involve law enforcement, is for school officials to decide in each individual case. Educators routinely assess how to deal with behavior that can range from mentions of weapons in social media posts to students joking about bomb threats, all while weighing safety concerns against a student's right to earn an education. There is no such thing as the perfect school safety and crisis response protocol, said Stephen Brock, a lead author on the subjects for the National Association of School Psychologists curriculum. Widely accepted best practices for threat assessment have been adapted from Secret Service guidance developed in the years since the 1999 Columbine School massacre. The agency's National Threat Assessment Center recommends multidisciplinary teams of school administrators, security, and mental health professionals be established to assess whether a student would be helped by counseling, should be reported to police, sent back to class, or something in between. To set blanket policy, for example, always sending students home for certain acts, would be to go backward to an era of zero tolerance policies, when everyone was punished but few students got help, said Lena Eleftheri, chief of the Secret Service National Threat Assessment Center. You have to rely on your assessments to guide your response, which is why this multidisciplinary approach is so important. You want the mental health perspective, but you also want the student resource officer perspective, because they will bring that operational, investigative mindset to ask the questions, whether something is an imminent risk or not, she said. Michael Lubefeld, superintendent of North Shore School District 112 in Highland Park, Illinois, described an all-hands-on-deck approach, whether a report comes in about a scuffle between students or a serious threat. He recalled a scenario in one of the district's middle schools last year in which a child was overheard indicating he wanted to do a violent act. It was close to the end of the day, with little time to investigate, so he summoned police, who arrived in force. It was unsubstantiated, but we didn't have time to really do a thoughtful investigation, Lubefeld said. So we basically called in the cavalry and informed the community why we did it. I would rather overreact, he said, and I can take the criticism for that. The Michigan attack came only hours after the defendant, Ethan Crumley, returned to class after the school summoned him and his parents to discuss worrying behavior, including the drawing with the gun and the words, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me." Ethan told a counselor it was part of a video game he was designing. After the shooting, authorities learned his father had bought the gun his son used 4 days before. A prosecutor, in taking the unusual step of charging the parents with involuntary manslaughter, said James and Jennifer Crumley knew their son had access to the gun, but didn't ask him about it after being shown the drawing, and resisted taking him home from school after the meeting. They have pleaded not guilty. There are legal considerations for schools, especially if a student's behavior is not found to pose an imminent risk, said Melissa Reeves, a psychologist and co-author of the NASP's curriculum. If parents don't agree with the school and the situation doesn't seem to merit intervention from a social services agency, our hands are tied because we are legally obligated to educate, she said. We can't deny access to education. Districts have faced lawsuits from parents claiming schools have overreacted and unfairly punished students for harmless remarks or actions or underreacted to tragic consequences. You're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't, said Dan Domenech, director of the AASA, a national superintendents group. In his third school year disrupted by the pandemic, he said, students are acting out more than ever, further straining the people tasked with figuring out if a student is just blowing off steam or about to erupt. Meriden, Connecticut Superintendent Mark Beghini said the district has gotten pushback for searching students' bags, sending them home, or involving police. The last thing I want to do is keep a kid out of school. I know they can't learn when they're not here, he said. But at the end of the day, my obligation is to make sure I'm creating a safe environment, and I'm not going to apologize when I need to suspend a student. Near the start of the school year in September, an emailed threat from a high school student circulated among students at Fleming County Schools in Kentucky. The student was expelled after review by the district's threat assessment team. Superintendent Brian Kreisman said the student did not have access to weapons, but the team determined the student needed some kind of help. We're going to take as long as we need to make sure we're not putting that student who may have issues back into a classroom who could hurt him or herself or hurt others, Kreisman said. It's not necessarily about punishing the kid for communicating the threat, he said. We want to help the kid address what is going on. Redistricting. GOP chips away at Black Dems' power by Nick Corasaniti and Reed J. Epstein, The New York Times Company. More than 30 years ago, Robert Reeves Sr. marched into a meeting of his county government in Sanford, North Carolina, with a demand: create a predominantly black district in the county, which was 23% black at the time, but had no black representation, or face a lawsuit under the Voting Rights Act. The county commission refused, and Reeves prepared to sue. But after the county settled and redrew its districts, he was elected in 1990 as Lee County's first black commissioner, a post he has held comfortably ever since. Until this year, Republicans, newly in power and in control of the redrawing of county maps, extended the district to the northeast, adding more rural and suburban white voters to the mostly rural districts southwest of Raleigh, effectively diluting the influence of its black voters. Reeves, who is still the county's only black commissioner, fears he will now lose his seat. They all have the same objective, he said, referring to local Republican officials, to get me out of the seat. Reeves is one of a growing number of black elected officials, ranging from members of Congress to county commissioners, who have been drawn out of their districts, placed in newly competitive districts, or bundled into new districts where they must vie against incumbents from their own party. Almost all of the affected lawmakers are Democrats, and most of the map makers are white Republicans. The GOP is currently seeking to widen its advantage in several states, including North Carolina, Ohio, Georgia, and Texas. And because partisan gerrymandering has long been difficult to disentangle from racial gerrymandering, proving the motive can be troublesome. But the effect remains the same: less political power for communities of color. The pattern has grown more pronounced during this year's redistricting cycle, the first since the Supreme Court struck down the heart of the Voting Rights Act in 2013 and allowed jurisdictions with a history of voting discrimination to pass election laws and draw political maps without approval from the Justice Department. Let's call it a five-alarm fire. G.K. Butterfield, a black congressman from North Carolina, said of the current round of congressional redistricting, he is retiring next year after Republicans removed Pitt County, which is about 35% black, from his district. "I just didn't see it coming," he said. "I did not believe that they would go to that extreme." A former chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Butterfield said fellow black members of Congress were increasingly worried about the new Republican-drawn maps. "We are all rattled," he said. In addition to Butterfield, four black state senators from North Carolina, five black members of the state House of Representatives, and several black county officials have had their districts altered in ways that could cost them their seats. Nearly 24 hours after the maps were passed, civil rights groups sued the state. Across the country, the number of elected officials of color who have had their districts changed in such ways is difficult to pinpoint. The New York Times identified more than two dozen of these officials, but there are probably significantly more in county and municipal districts. But the number of black legislators being drawn out of their districts outpaces that of recent redistricting cycles, when voting rights groups frequently found themselves in court trying to preserve existing majority-minority districts as often as they sought to create new ones. "Without a doubt, it's worse than it was in any recent decade," said Leah Aden, a deputy director of litigation at the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund, Incorporated. "We have so much to contend with, and it's all happening very quickly." Republicans, who have vastly more control over redistricting nationally than Democrats do, defend their maps as legal and fair. Kirk Smith, the Republican chairman of the Lee County's Board of Commissioners, said that to say only a person of a certain racial or ethnic group can represent only a person of the same racial or ethnic group has all the trappings of ethnocentric racism. In North Carolina and elsewhere, Republicans say that their new maps are race blind, meaning officials use no racial data in designing the maps and therefore could not have drawn racially discriminatory districts because they had no idea where communities of color were. During the 2011 redistricting process, legislators considered race when drawing districts. Ralph Heiss, a Republican state senator in North Carolina, said in a statement. Through a spokesperson, he declined to answer specific questions, citing pending litigation. His statement continued, "We were then sued for considering race and ordered to draw new districts. So during this process, legislators did not use any racial data when drawing districts, and we're now being sued for not considering race." In other states, mapmakers have declined to add new districts with majorities of people of color, even though the populations of minority residents have boomed. In Texas, where the population has increased by 4 million since the 2010 redistricting cycle, people of color account for more than 95% of the growth. But the state legislature drew two new congressional seats with majority white populations. efforts to curb racial gerrymandering have been hampered by a 2019 Supreme Court decision, which ruled partisan gerrymandering could not be challenged in federal court. Although the court did leave intact Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits racial gerrymandering, it offered no concrete guidance on how to distinguish between a partisan gerrymander and a racial gerrymander when the result was both, such as in heavily Democratic Black communities. Given that certain demographic groups have aligned tightly with political parties, 90% of Black voters in Georgia voted Democratic in 2020, for example, officials drawing gerrymandered maps could simply argue that politics were at play, not race. How many more will we lose? Despite many people's perception that COVID-19 is no longer a threat, the virus caused about 14% of all deaths in Colorado since the more virulent Delta variant took over in early July, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. More than one in four people who have died of COVID-19 in Colorado lost their battle after vaccines were widely available. The state lifted nearly all pandemic health restrictions, and Governor Jared Polis declared the public health emergency was over. Colorado surpassed 10,000 deaths from COVID-19 last week, but more than 2,900 of those came since the start of July, according to preliminary data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Those who died in the subsequent months were slightly younger than in previous waves, and the vast majority were unvaccinated. Russell Thompson's uncle, Albert Martinez, was one of them. Martinez, of Denver, died earlier this month after a short battle with the virus. He was 62 and had experienced lung trouble for years, but was more worried about the vaccine than the disease, Thompson said. It's an attitude he sees in others, including some who insist COVID-19 wasn't really what killed Martinez, he said. I know people who still don't believe it, and it's insane, Thompson said. Despite many people's perception that COVID-19 is no longer a threat, the virus caused about 14% of all deaths in Colorado since the more virulent Delta variant took over in early July, according to the CDC data. That's similar to earlier stages of the pandemic. About 12% of all Colorado deaths between mid-March 2020 and the end of June 2021 were caused by the virus. Even with the ongoing fifth wave, however, Colorado is in the bottom 10 states for COVID-19 deaths compared to population. Almost every state has experienced an increase in hospitalizations and deaths since summer, and it's not clear how much severe disease the new Omicron variant will cause as it starts to compete with Delta. In a statement, Polis said the state's COVID-19 death toll would have been significantly worse if fewer Coloradans were vaccinated. About 70% of Colorado adults had received at least one dose when the current wave began. Now, nearly 69% of eligible Coloradans, those 5 and older, are fully vaccinated. This pandemic has caused pain and challenges for families and kids across our state. Every death is a tragedy and a loved one, Polis said. Misinformation and disinformation have preyed on far too many Coloradans, making them unnecessarily the victims of COVID's most severe outcomes, even though it was easily prevented. Experts believe the virus's toll will gradually decrease over the coming years, as more people are vaccinated or survive the disease and develop some level of immunity. How long that will take and how many more people will be lost will depend on a combination of human behavior, biology, and luck. The other question is what level of death most people will decide is tolerable, said Beth Carlton, an associate professor of environmental and occupational health at the Colorado School of Public Health and a member of the state's COVID-19 modeling team. People accept some flu deaths each year as a cost of keeping everything open during the winter months. But the current level of death from COVID-19 is much higher than what we've normally tolerated, she said. It's this constant tension, Carlton said. How do we balance this need for infection control and to have a functioning society? Victims were younger, mostly unvaccinated. The people lost in the wave that started in July were younger, on average, than those who died earlier in the pandemic. Older people are still at a higher risk of dying from COVID-19, and those 75 and older accounted for about 44% of deaths in the current wave, according to data from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment. That's down significantly from the average of 62% of previous waves, though, indicating deaths among middle-aged and younger people aren't as rare as they once were. High vaccination rates among older people helped to limit the death toll, and fewer people would have died if more had received the shot, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said. Even when the virus got into long-term care facilities in the last few months, it didn't cause nearly the rate of severe illness and death that it did in 2020, she said. Nearly three-quarters of Colorado's COVID-19 deaths in October, the most recent month with full data on the vaccination status of those who died, were among the unvaccinated. Jackie Washburn's son, Ryan, 44, was one of those victims. Washburn said she got vaccinated and urged Ryan to do so. But he believed conspiracy theories that the vaccine contained a tracking chip and thought his active lifestyle would protect him. I said, Ryan, do you think the government wants to know where a 70-year-old woman goes? I go to Walmart, she recalled. After he contracted the virus in October, Ryan couldn't eat more than a few bites at a time because of nausea, loss of taste, and other symptoms, Washburn said. He went to the emergency rooms of two Colorado Springs hospitals, which turned him away because they determined he wasn't sick enough for a bed when they were so close to capacity, she said. One ambulance also declined to transport him before his oxygen levels dropped enough that a second ambulance crew determined he needed emergency care. Ryan's doctors and nurses said he seemed to be on the mend, though his oxygen needs kept increasing until he had to be intubated, Washburn said. He had a heart attack during his first night on a ventilator and died a few days later on October 31st. While there's no way to be certain, Washburn believes Ryan might have survived if he'd been able to get a bed sooner. Hospitals across the state were nearing capacity as they attempted to deal with an increase in patients with COVID-19 and other illnesses, with fewer nurses and other frontline staff than they had during the previous surges. It's difficult to lose a child under any circumstances, but what makes it worse is that Ryan's life finally was coming together after some youthful missteps, Washburn said. He'd recently gotten married and bought a house for his four children, and he was always there if someone needed help, she said. I have a strong faith, and I know that he's at peace and in paradise, but I sure do miss him, she said, her voice breaking. Low vaccination rates, Delta, and pandemic fatigue. A year ago, when the first COVID-19 vaccines arrived in Colorado, it seemed unlikely the state would be worried about hospital capacity again. Cases and hospitalizations were both dropping precipitously from the early December peak of the third wave. Instead of worrying about whether the state could run out of hospital beds, officials talked about when there would be enough doses available for everyone who wanted the shot and who should go first. In December of 2020, with the new vaccines being released, we at the state said that by the fall of 2021, things will be much better, said Dr. Eric France, Chief Medical Officer for Colorado's Public Health Department. I think by the summer it was less of a surprise to see another wave. More people hesitated to take the vaccine than expected, with demand plateauing after a rush in the first months that shots were available. Still, the level of immunity in the state was enough to significantly limit the damage from the fourth wave in spring 2021, even as the state was loosening restrictions. Colorado wouldn't be so fortunate with the Delta variant, which was first detected in Mesa County in early May. Delta was more contagious than Alpha, the so-called UK variant first identified in Colorado late last year, and displaced it within a month. It also brought an increased risk of breakthrough infections among vaccinated people and caused more severe disease in those who were still unvaccinated. Scientists don't have one clear explanation for why some waves prove self-limiting, while others cause so much more illness and death, Herlihy said. Seasonality is one factor. So is the virus's tendency to run through the susceptible people in an area with a large wave of infection, die down to more manageable levels, and flare up again when it encounters another large group that's not immune, she said. By late summer and early fall, immunity was starting to wane for people who'd been vaccinated over the winter or recovered from the virus last year, while more than 1 million people remained unvaccinated and potentially vulnerable. That's a lot of people for the virus to infect and kill, France said. The desire to get back to normal and the effects of the Delta variant compounded to produce catastrophic loss of life in Colorado and around the country, said Carlton, the associate professor at the Colorado School of Public Health. Delta ended up being much more virulent and making people a lot sicker, she said. That wasn't immediately obvious, though, and a week after the first Delta cases were found, Polis largely lifted the mask mandate, declaring it applied only to unvaccinated people in certain settings, like healthcare facilities. The state rapidly got a preview of what Delta might do, though, as Mesa County intensive care units were pushed to capacity by early June. About 2 weeks later, Herlihy warned unvaccinated people were more vulnerable than ever. Still, Polis declared the state's public health emergency was over on July 8th. Our hospital capacity is no longer in jeopardy, he told the Denver Post at the time. Within 2 months, that was no longer the case. By late August, some hospitals already reported they were delaying non-emergency surgeries to free up space. And the number of people being treated for COVID-19 was at levels last seen in mid-January. In response, Polis issued an order requiring state employees in settings like healthcare facilities and prisons to get vaccinated, and asked the State Board of Health to require almost all workers in the health field to do the same. Still, by mid-September, the state had fewer beds available in intensive care units than it had during the worst of the fall 2020 surge. And the odds any given person was contagious with COVID-19 were at their highest levels of the year. State officials urged Coloradans to get booster shots to reduce the odds of breakthrough infections. They also encouraged everyone to wear masks in indoor public places, though Polis ruled out a statewide mandate. Colorado didn't take more aggressive measures until early November, when Polis announced the state was calling on the Federal Emergency Management Agency for staffing help, opening booster eligibility to all adults, and expanding access to monoclonal antibody treatments, which reduce the odds a high-risk person with COVID-19 will be hospitalized. It's not clear if those measures made the difference, but hospitalizations began to fall shortly before Thanksgiving. Between early July and the peak, more than 2,500 people had died. More died in the following weeks, as some of those infected earlier lost their battles. There's widespread agreement that states couldn't return to lockdown, said Lisa Miller, a professor of epidemiology at the Colorado School of Public Health. It's difficult to know if the outcome would have been any different if the state had taken the actions it did sooner or had taken other steps like mandating masks again, she said. I think researchers will be looking at these questions for years, she said. The level of death many states saw wasn't inevitable, given the relative success countries like Canada have had in limiting mortality, said Dr. David Doughty, an infectious disease epidemiologist at Johns Hopkins University. Canada has recorded about 80 deaths for every 100,000 people, and the United States rate is roughly 3 times that. Given the difficulty getting people to accept new public health measures and an unwillingness to comply with the more restrictive precautions used last year, though, states may not have had many options to reduce their death tolls, Doughty said. In a perfect world, many of those deaths would have been prevented. But we don't live in a perfect world, he said. It's unlikely that Colorado could have kept itself safe while the virus was raging in the rest of the country. How many more will we lose? Experts agree that the SARS-CoV-2 virus is unlikely to ever be eradicated, meaning it will continue to cause some harm for the foreseeable future. How much depends on how many people get vaccinated or get a booster shot, how long immunity lasts, how virulent future versions of the virus are, and what level of death people are willing to tolerate before accepting restrictions again. The right balance is not no death. The right balance is less death than what we're having now, Doughty said, citing public tolerance of flu deaths. Colorado isn't close to bringing COVID-19 deaths down to seasonal flu levels, though. In 2019, the state lost 468 people to flu or pneumonia across the multi-month season, roughly 2 weeks' worth of deaths from COVID-19 this November. The state isn't likely to vaccinate everyone who remains susceptible anytime soon. While uptake has increased anytime a new variant is announced and when hospitals are filling up, there's a natural plateauing with any new vaccine or treatment after the most eager people have received it, France said. While some counties reinstated mask mandates until hospitalizations came down, there's little appetite for any restrictions at the state level. Polis has pushed booster shots and announced plans to add 500 staff beds in hospitals and facilities like nursing homes to ease the strain on capacity. He's largely framed illness and death among the unvaccinated as a result of free choice. I have no qualms if unvaccinated people have a death wish, but they're clogging our hospitals, the governor said at a press conference in early November. It's unclear what the newest variant, Omicron, will bring. Models from the CDC projected two possible scenarios: a large wave of cases, possibly peaking as soon as January, or a smaller wave topping out in the spring. Omicron is more contagious than Delta and more likely to cause breakthrough cases in people who are vaccinated or reinfect those who recovered from a previous variant. Some early data suggests it may cause less severe illness, but that's not certain at this point. Over time, waves of the virus are expected to become less severe as more people develop some level of immunity, Doughty said. This wave is not as bad as the one before, he said. I think we should just accept the reality that they're going to happen. Hits keep coming. Hospitals struggle as COVID-19 beds fill, by Ed White, The Associated Press, byline Detroit. Hospitals across the country are struggling to cope with burnout among doctors, nurses, and other workers, already buffeted by a crush of patients from the ongoing surge of the COVID-19 Delta variant and now bracing for the fallout of another highly transmissible mutation. Ohio became the latest state to summon the National Guard to help overwhelm medical facilities. Experts in Nebraska warned that its hospitals soon may need to ration care. Medical officials in Kansas and Missouri are delaying surgeries, turning away transfers, and desperately trying to hire traveling nurses as cases double and triple in an eerie reminder of last year's holiday season. There is no medical school class that can prepare you for this level of death, said Dr. Jacqueline Flom Carlson, an emergency medicine specialist at Henry Ford Health System in Detroit. The hits just keep coming. The national 7-day average of COVID-19 hospital admissions was 60,000 by Wednesday, far off last winter's peak, but 50% higher than in early November, the government reported. The situation is more acute in cold weather regions, where people are increasingly gathering inside and new infections are piling up. New York State reported Saturday that more than 21,900 people had tested positive for COVID-19 the day before, a new high since tests became widely available. Consequences of the latest surge have been swift in New York City. The Rockettes' Christmas show was scratched for the season. Some Broadway shows canceled performances because of outbreaks among cast members. And Saturday Night Live announced it was taping without a live audience and with only limited cast and crew. We are in a situation where we are now facing a very important Delta surge, and we are looking over our shoulder at an oncoming Omicron surge. Dr. Anthony Fauci, chief medical advisor to President Joe Biden, said of the two COVID variants. At Advent Health Shawnee Mission, a hospital near Kansas City, Missouri, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Lisa Hayes said the emergency department is experiencing backups, sometimes lasting 4 days. The beds are not the issue. It's the nurses to staff the beds. And it's all created by rising COVID numbers and burnout, Hayes said. Our nurses are burnt out. Experts attribute most of the rise in cases and hospitalizations to infections among people who have not been inoculated against the coronavirus. The government says 61% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated. Dr. Steve Stites, chief medical officer at University of Kansas Health System in Kansas City, Kansas, said the pandemic of the unvaccinated continues to swamp the hospital and its workers. There's no place to go. Our staff are tired. We're going to run out of travelers, Stites said, referring to visiting healthcare workers. And Omicron is at our doorstep. This is a tornado warning to our community. Ohio's National Guard deployment is one of the largest seen during the pandemic, with more than 1,000 members sent to beleaguered hospitals, especially in the Akron, Canton, and Cleveland areas. As of Friday, 4,723 people in the state were hospitalized with the coronavirus, a number last seen about a year ago, Governor Mike DeWine said. Some staffers were taking only short breaks before punching in for second shifts, he added. Health systems elsewhere that are doing somewhat better are nervously eyeing the arrival of the Omicron variant and girding themselves for the impact. Nebraska officials said hospitals might have to put some care on hold to make room for COVID-19 patients. While case numbers are down from the state's pandemic peak, they could rebound rapidly, and bed availability remains tight because of patients with non-virus ailments. It may be likely that Omicron will cause a giant surge, and honestly, we can't handle that right now, said Dr. Angela Hewlett of Nebraska Medicine in Omaha. At Los Angeles' Providence Holy Cross Medical Center, just 17 coronavirus patients were being treated there Friday, a small fraction of the hospital's worst stretch. Nurse manager Edgar Ramirez said his coworkers are weary but better prepared if a wave hits. The human factor of having that fear is always going to be there, Ramirez said. I tell our crew, we have to talk through this. We have to express ourselves. Otherwise, it's going to be tough. Twin sisters Lisa Calderon and Natalie Bali, 71, had planned to get vaccinated, but delayed it until it was too late. Now they're on oxygen in the same room at Providence Holy Cross, their bed separated by just a few feet. We kept saying, we'll do it tomorrow. But tomorrow never came, Calderon said as she watched her sister struggle to breathe. We really regret not getting the shots, because if we did, we wouldn't be like this right now. Flom Carlson, the doctor at Detroit's Henry Ford Health, made a public plea for people to get the shots, both for their benefit and for those toiling on the front lines of care. Have a little grace and consideration in how devastating things are right now, she said. Biden nominees. Senate confirms a big slate of ambassadors. By Kevin Freiking, The Associated Press, Byline, Washington. The Senate confirmed more than 30 ambassadors and other Biden administration nominees early Saturday after Majority Leader Chuck Schumer agreed to schedule a vote on sanctions on the company behind the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that will deliver natural gas from Russia to Germany. With many senators anxious to go home for the holidays, Schumer, Democrat of New York, threatened to keep the Senate in for as long as it took to break a logjam on a broad array of diplomatic and national security nominees. Rahm Emanuel, the former mayor of Chicago, was confirmed to serve as ambassador to Japan by a vote of 48-21. Nominees to be ambassadors to Spain, Vietnam, and Somalia were among those confirmed by voice vote soon afterward. The votes came after an agreement was reached to hold a vote concerning Nord Stream 2 sanctions before January 14th. The confirmation process has proved to be frustrating for new presidential administrations, regardless of party. While gridlock isn't new, the struggle to staff administrations is getting worse. Democrats have increasingly voiced concerns about holds that a few GOP senators placed on nominees to raise objections about foreign policy matters that had little to do with the nominee. The holds don't block a nominee from being confirmed, but they do require the Senate to undertake hours of debate that could be used on other priorities. As a result, positions requiring Senate confirmation can go unfilled for several months, even when the nominations are approved in committee with the support of senators from both parties. Biden administration officials acknowledge the president will end his year with significantly more ambassadorial vacancies than recent predecessors, and that the slowdown of ambassadorial and other national security picks has already had an impact on U.S. relations overseas. Senator Ted Cruz, Republican of Texas, held up dozens of nominees at the Departments of State and Treasury over objections to the administration's waiving of sanctions targeting the Nord Stream AG firm overseeing the pipeline project. The administration said at the time that it opposed the project, but viewed it as a fait accompli. Tornadoes. Midwest family members mourning those they lost, by John Hanna and Sudan Thanawala, The Associated Press. Aniston Rackley was an outgoing and energetic 9-year-old who didn't let a rare liver condition prevent her from the activities she loved, swimming, dancing, and cheerleading, her great aunt, Sandra Hooker, said. The girl delighted in donning outfits and makeup for cheer competitions and would frequently do cartwheels and the splits in front of family members. I would just gasp because she could do the splits all the time, and she would just laugh, Hooker recalled. She loved dancing. Aniston was among at least 92 people who were confirmed dead across multiple states after more than 40 tornadoes pummeled a large area last weekend. The victims included grandmothers, veterans, and in some cases, multiple members of a single family. On one street in Bowling Green, Kentucky, 12 people died, 8 of them children. 7 of the 12 were members of one family. Their grief-stricken neighbors are surrounded by ruins that included countless children's toys. The sudden bereavement has left loved ones reeling and clinging to memories. Katie Field says she doesn't want her father, 60-year-old Carl Hogan of Dawson Springs, Kentucky, remembered as the guy who died in the tornado. Hogan loved to fish and loved his green Chevrolet truck, she said, and he was a fan of the TV show Yellowstone. His 4 grandchildren were his world, she said, and Hogan was a fantastic father. He was religious, but it was a quiet, private faith, Field said. He was truly just a good man. Hogan was incredibly devoted to his wife of 41 years, and he was looking forward to getting her back home following a stay in a hospital and nursing home that began in February, Field said. Elsewhere in Dawson Springs, Jason Cummins has been combing through the debris of the home his mother, Marcia Hall, and her sister, Carol Grisham, shared, keeping anything still intact, a key, a doorknob that might remind him of them. Hall, 72, and Grisham, 80, were referred to simply as the sisters around Dawson Springs, friend Jenny Bashir Sewell said. They were often each other's company and had lived in the same home for years, according to Cummins. They really just took care of each other, said Cummins, 43. It was always the two of them. They were best friends. Cummins said he texted his aunt and mother good morning and told them he loved them every day. On the day of the storm, he added that they should watch the weather. He was tracking the storm on Facebook that night and told Hall to get Grisham and go to the hallway. In news briefs, feds extend deadline for companies to mandate vaccines. The Labor Department said on Saturday that it would delay until February 9th the deadline for full enforcement of its rule requiring large companies to have their workers get coronavirus vaccines or be tested weekly, after weeks of legal battles created uncertainty and confusion for employers. The department's move came a day after a federal appeals panel reinstated the Biden administration's rule requiring that companies with at least 100 employees mandate their workers be vaccinated against the coronavirus or face weekly testing by January 4th. The rule had also mandated that those employers require masks for unvaccinated workers by December 5th. The Labor Department said in a statement that it would not issue citations for noncompliance with any requirements of the rule before January 10th. It said it would not issue citations for noncompliance with the standards testing requirements before February 9th, so long as an employer is exercising reasonable, good faith efforts to come into compliance with the standard. Typhoon leaves 31 dead in Philippines, byline Manila. A powerful typhoon left at least 31 people dead, knocked out power and communications in entire provinces, and wrought widespread destruction, mostly in the central Philippines, officials said Saturday. A governor said her island has been leveled to the ground. Typhoon Ray blew away Friday night into the South China Sea after rampaging through southern and central island provinces, where more than 300,000 people in its path were evacuated to safety in advance in a preemptive move officials say may have saved a lot of lives. At its strongest, Ray packed sustained winds of 121 miles per hour with gusts of up to 168 miles per hour, one of the most powerful in recent years to hit the disaster-prone Southeast Asian archipelago, which lies between the Pacific Ocean and the South China Sea. The typhoon slammed into the country's southeastern coast Thursday, but the extent of casualties and destruction remained unclear. 2 days after, with entire provinces still without power and cell phone connection. Gas explosion in sewer kills 12 in Pakistan's largest city, byline Karachi. A powerful gas explosion in a sewer system in Pakistan's largest city, Karachi, killed at least 12 people and injured 11 others Saturday, police and a health official said. Police spokesman Sohail Jokhio said the blast was apparently caused when something ignited gas that had accumulated in the sewer beneath a local building in the Shershah neighborhood of the port city. Jokhio said it was not clear yet what ignited the gas, but a team of explosives experts had been summoned to investigate. Fire damages sprawling QVC distribution center. A huge fire broke out at a distribution center for QVC, the home shopping network, on Saturday morning in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, ripping through the 1.2 million square foot building and damaging three quarters of it, officials said. There were 300 employees in the building when the fire started, manager Eric Evans said at a news conference Saturday afternoon. QVC and authorities believe that everyone in the building made it out safely, he said. The one person remained unaccounted for. Novavax vaccine wins emergency approval from WHO. The World Health Organization granted emergency authorization to a COVID-19 vaccine produced by Maryland-based Novavax and the Serum Institute of India, opening the door for the vaccine, also called Novavax, to be distributed to lower-income countries around the world. The news of its authorization came as governments around the world reimposed coronavirus restrictions, bracing themselves for a surge in cases brought on by the new Omicron variant. These were from Denver Post Wire Services. In Colorado briefs, two more teens arrested in Aurora in connection to drive-by shooting. Two more teenage suspects were arrested Friday in connection to the drive-by shooting of six teens in Aurora. One suspect, a 15-year-old, was arrested at about 12:30 p.m. as he was getting into a vehicle at a shopping center near East 6th Avenue and Chambers Road, police said in a news release. A second suspect, 16, was arrested 10 minutes later at a traffic stop in the 300 block of Potomac Street. The department's Fugitive Apprehension and Surveillance Team, FAST, and SWAT team made the arrests without incident. Both suspects were arrested on suspicion of attempted first-degree murder, police said. The shooting happened on November 15th in Nome Park, East 12th Avenue and Nome Street, adjacent to Aurora Central High School. The day of the incident, five of the teens, three boys and two girls between the ages of 14 and 17, were transported by ambulance to area hospitals. An 18-year-old drove himself to the hospital with minor injuries, police said. One victim underwent emergency surgery. The day of the shooting, teenagers in the park exchanged gunfire with teens in the vehicles, a Chevrolet Tahoe and Chrysler 300, police said. Two other 15-year-old suspects in the ongoing case were arrested on November 22nd and 23rd. They have been charged with attempted first-degree murder. Officers connected to fatal shooting identified. Four officers with the Colorado Springs Police Department connected to a fatal police shooting have been identified. Officers Scott Ferguson, Ray Shepard, Ryan Payne, and Thorin Fash are on administrative leave per department policy following the December 10th shooting in the 3600 block of Austin Bluffs Parkway, according to a police news release on Friday. At about 2:10 a.m. the day of the incident, officers encountered a man in a vehicle behind a business and told him to get out of the vehicle, a news release said. The man fired a gun at officers, who returned fire. The man then barricaded himself inside the vehicle. The man again fired at officers, and at least one CSPD officer returned fire, police said in an earlier news release. The man was found dead inside the vehicle. No officers were injured. The El Paso County Sheriff's Office is the lead agency in the ongoing police shooting investigation. These were from Denver Post staff reports. Legislature. Officials will push for more density. 10% of state's $4 billion stimulus set aside for things like grants and loans to help with growing housing crisis. By Alex Burness, The Denver Post. Colorado's housing crisis is now such that even people making above-average salaries are struggling to rent or buy at rates they can't afford. State lawmakers appear mostly united on at least one way the state should address this problem: embracing density over sprawl and single-family development. In the coming legislative session, which begins January 12th, lawmakers plan to create incentives for developers and local governments around the state to prioritize dense, multifamily housing as a means of promoting relative affordability in a state where home prices have risen at least 457% in three decades. It's not about density for density's sake, they say. For a number of reasons, everything from just the pure cost of land to tap fees to the inefficiency one house at a time gets you, building taller and denser makes more sense in terms of the math of trying to finance these projects and actually make them happen, said State Senator Julie Gonzalez, a Denver Democrat and vice chair of the Legislative Task Force on Affordable Housing that is wrapping up its study now. State government won't command change at the local level, even if it were so motivated. The legislature could not abolish single-family zoning without inviting lawsuits centered around local control laws. But it does plan to encourage some change. Colorado leaders have set aside 10% of the historic $4 billion it's received in federal stimulus money, a total that represents about 10 times the amount of discretionary spending lawmakers generally get to make in a given legislative session. And much of that money set aside for housing is primed to go toward grants and low-interest loans meant to encourage developers and cities to build or preserve affordable units. The definition of affordable is somewhat flexible in this case. Colorado's got an estimated shortage of more than 100,000 units for people at the lowest end of the income scale, but lawmakers appear just as, if not more, focused now on people who earn average or slightly above average salaries and who cannot afford to live where they work. Nurses, firefighters, teachers, said Brian Rossbert, executive director of the nonprofit Housing Colorado and the chair of a panel that's been advising the legislative task force on affordable housing. Across the housing spectrum and across income levels, there is a need for more housing, for more units to be built, and a need for units to be preserved as affordable. How might Colorado incentivize housing density? How precisely the legislature will spend on this priority isn't clear yet. Early proposals suggest as much as $208 million on loan funds meant to achieve goals, including helping developers build new affordable units and assisting in the purchasing of units that can be preserved as affordable. The task force has also explored spending up to $164 million on nonprofit and local government grants. These and other possible spending plans for 2022 have the potential to either create or preserve more than 250,000 housing units in the state over the next 15 years, the task force estimates. That's about a tenth of the total existing housing stock in Colorado as of 2019, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.